System on RadioArea.com.
Richard Edmonds is without doubt the most respected active nationalist in Britain today. In a movement that is increasingly becoming internet-based and anonymous, it is refreshing to have someone willing to stand up and speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Recently he did this at an interview with the BBC at Bush House for an hour and a half, thereabouts, and his interview was so good, the BBC didn't use it. Surprise, surprise. Today he will be taking a frank look at the movements, the British nationalist movements, and asking, among other things, what can we do to encourage people of the highest calibre, to get involved and fight for the cause. So without further ado, put your hands together and give a very, very warm welcome to the first meeting of the South West Forum, Richard Edmonds.
Thank you very much for inviting me to this meeting of the South West Forum. The Bristol area, the whole of the South West of England, moving over into South Wales, has always been a stronghold of British nationalism for the last 40 years. So I really appreciate speaking at this meeting, and I appreciate Julie and Jez for organising this meeting, and what a great turnout. It shows that our movement is still alive, that the heart is still beating, and that we still have hope in our hearts. And we have every reason to have hope in our hearts, and this is the very theme that I want to address this afternoon. When Jez invited me here, I spoke to Jez and we went back and forth with a few ideas, and I said that I think that it should be a stock-taking, and I would like to address the theme, where do we go from here? And in particular, I would like to speak and focus in last week's parliamentary by-election up there in West Yorkshire, where I stood in the constituency of Batley and Spen. I must say, before I get into the politics, and before we look at the results, which we all know, of course, Batley is a nice little town. Cleckheaton's a nice little town. Heckmondwike is a nice little town that's more industrial. They are very attractive towns up there, and it's a very attractive part of the world, minus the foreigners, of course. So, I'm going to focus on the results that the Nationalist Party's got in Batley and Spen, and what the Nationalist candidates got in Batley and Spen, myself included. And I'm going to ask some questions. How did it come about that all the candidates of that by-election, minus the Labour Party, lost their deposits? How does it come about that the BNP candidate, the British National Party candidate, was beaten by the civic nationalists of the so-called English Democrats? How was the BNP beaten when, on the same day, in the parallel parliamentary by-election in Cameron's old seat of Witney in Oxfordshire, the English Democrats put up the Englishman, the West Indian former boxer, Winston McKenzie? And how did it come about that I got the vote that I did? I have come here to answer these questions. The brutal facts are that we British nationalists are starting from the very beginning again, and these election results confirm it. We are starting from the very beginning again because the party that most of us were members of in this room, I think, certainly most of us in this room were active members of, and which I was a founder member of, the British National Party, is now on its last legs, and near its end. The BNP, that in its time fulfilled its role of giving heart and education and spirit to the British people, the British National Party, which in its time performed political miracles. The BNP at one time had 50 elected borough councillors, a county councillor, 2 Euro MPs, and a man on the Greater London Assembly. And all that is in the past tense. without crying over spilt milk, without spending time on recriminations and autopsy. The fact is, the British National Party was destroyed by gross maladministration at the top of the party, and the BNP is effectively no more. So the question is, and why you've all come here, is to ask the question, where do we go from here? We, who live in a country whose major cities are being reduced to crime-racked riot zones, where no one would want to live and where no one would want to raise a family. We who live in a country where there's been so much immigration that now the top name for newborn baby boys across the whole of England and Wales is Mohammed. And we who live in a country whose capital city we are now the minority in. We who live in a country whose politicians have lied at every election for the last 50 years. I remember the general election of 1959. I was 16 years of age in 1959 and taking an interest in politics. I remember that 1959 general election. In the 1950s, the British people did not want a multiracial society set up in this country. In the 1950s, people did not want the race problems of the United States of America and the race problems of apartheid South Africa imported into Britain. And people in the 1950s said so very, very loudly. So how did the Tories deal with this situation? And how did the Tories manage to get a huge majority at that 1959 general election? The Tory leader, Harold Macmillan, went to the country and said, vote Conservative. This is 1959. Vote Conservative and we will stop immigration. That's 50 years ago. These events are burnt into my mind. In fact, those events helped to propel me to where I am now. I've never forgotten the lies. For 50 years, the Tories lie at every general election. For the last 50 years, the Labour Party has lied at every general election. The Labour Party has never told the electorate, never told the voters, never told its own supporters that the Labour Party wants to flood this country with millions of foreigners. They want to displace us and replace us. The Labour Party has never told the electorate that, not for 50 years. The Labour Party has never told the British people that they want to change the demographics of Britain, as they have the audacity to say, the audacity to admit. The politicians of Westminster are deliberately destroying our Britain. They are committing the genocide of the British people. 50 more years of this, and we will not be. That is genocide. That is genocide. We are at a turning point in our history. Everyone can see that, and this explains the Brexit vote. The smashing, winning Brexit vote of this summer. The total rejection of that clique of failure politicians at Westminster. The total rejection of the politicians and the total rejection of all their deeds and works. Flooding us with millions of foreigners and surrendering our sovereignty and independence to the European Union. Everybody can see that the destruction of Britain and the impending genocide of the British people is willed and desired and implemented by the politicians. The Brexit vote and the acknowledgement, conscious or otherwise, of our impending genocide is the new political reality. The Brexit vote and the impending genocide of our people is the new political reality. Pause and consider. In this country, parties win a general election with about 11 million votes. They form the next government. Their man or their woman moves into number 10 Downing Street, wins a general election on round figures, 11 million votes. That 17 million angry Brexit votes, the 17 million Brexit votes, trumps 11 million votes every time. A friend of mine, who moves in relatively high social circles and is a good friend of this movement, I won't mention his name, listen, I've survived, I won't say thrived, but I've survived in nationalism for 40 years by being very discreet. I never drop names. And if you want to tell me something, I never divulge it. It all goes up into my brain box, right? I've got a brain box. Have I got a brain box with some facts in it? So, a friend of mine said, a top London barrister, if you must know, said, after the Brexit vote, that the British establishment, that crowd at Westminster, is defeated and demoralised and doesn't know what to do for the best. That's the establishment. After the Brexit vote, looking at 17 million angry Britons. So, ladies and gentlemen, fellow nationalist friends, what does all this mean to us? What does this mean to us after the Brexit vote and after the Batley and Spend vote? I haven't got to tell you, have I, how many votes I got at that parliamentary violation. So, what does all this mean? What does all this mean? It means that we British nationalists are starting from the beginning again. The BNP is finished. We are starting from the very beginning. That's what it means. And I have come here to tell you deliberately that there is nothing daunting about this situation whatsoever. Some of us have been here before. When Margaret Thatcher stole our National Front policies and got herself elected into number 10 as Prime Minister, the NF was left high and dry back then in 1979. After some confusion, the BNP was founded, and after some years of effort, great successes were achieved. We are at that moment again. We are at that moment again. But this time, the huge difference is that rather than making fools of themselves, as the British people did in 1979, rather than making fools of themselves and running after an obvious Tory failure, no good, as back in 79, this time the British people have rejected en masse that crowd of no goods at Westminster. Of course, there's going to be confusion. I'll put it in the present tense. Of course, there is confusion and demoralisation, as there was in 1982, when I and others, some of them in this room, helped to found the British National Party. But I will put it to you, and I've come to this meeting in the Southwest, to put it to you that the obvious political vehicle to rally the British people against 50 years of ongoing genocide that we've had from Westminster, the obvious political vehicle is the National Front. And I will tell you that the National Front was formed 50 years ago by some really top persons. Over there in my bag, I happen to have a copy of the headed notepaper of when the National Front was first founded, and you can see the names of the founders, and I'll show it to you if you want to look at this. I've got it over there. The founders of the National Front 50 years ago were some top military persons, including an admiral, some generals, RAF commanders, plus Oxford and other university academics, some top people founded the National Front 50 years ago, and they knew 50 years ago that the politicians at Westminster were leading our people to their doom and their destruction. And I will say to you that now, at this very, very dangerous juncture of our history, listen, the whole white race is facing wipeout. There's no doubt about that. Every white country is being betrayed by the politicians who run it. And in every white country, there are millions who vote for these politicians. That's what's so serious, that there are millions out there who vote for these politicians. But the good news is, and I haven't got to tell it to you because you know it already, the Brexit vote. Never forget the Brexit vote. That is without precedent in this country. Look, in the last 50 years, there's been upsets at parliamentary by-elections. Oh, I can remember when Eric Lubbock won Orpington. Look, my memory goes back a fantastic long time. Not quite as far as the dinosaurs, you understand, but certainly to 1962. I can remember the upset when the Tories lost a seat and the Lib Dems won a seat. For the last 50 years, there's been upsets at parliamentary by-elections, but never, never this scale at a major election. 17 million. Where did I get? I was talking about Eric Lubbock, wasn't I? So, at this very, very dangerous juncture, when the top name for baby boys in this country is Muhammad, when we are now a minority in our own country, in our own capital, you know, you can go on a tube train in London, you're the only British person on that train. Eh? And I tell you, you don't want to go on them buses late at night either, because you'll be the only vulnerable British person on those buses late at night. So, at this very, very dangerous juncture in our history, but with the Brexit vote, I will put to you that the National Front is the party to rally the British people. And I'd like to say one final thing here. For the last 50 years... For the last 50 years, the National Front has been given permission to take part in the ceremony at the Cenotaph on Remembrance Day, the ceremony to pay our respects to the fallen of the two world wars. For the last 50 years, including this coming Remembrance Day, 13th of November, the National Front lines up just across the road from Victoria Station at Bressenden Place. We line up at 1:15. We move off at 1:45. 1:45. We parade down Victoria Street. We parade past Westminster Abbey, where the kings and queens of this land have celebrated their coronation for the last 1,000 years. You know, we're a very old people. We've got a very old history. We parade round Parliament Square, past House of Parliament. We into Whitehall to the Cenotaph to lay wreaths. We march through the very historical and political centre of Britain. And we march with flags flying and drums beating. We march in good order, non-political, non-denominational. All patriots welcome, and I invite you, if you so wish, to attend our Remembrance Day, which we've held the last 50 years. I've got some freebie literature over there. I'm very, very pleased that the two organisers have organised this. The South West, including the South Wales has always been a very, very powerful stronghold of British nationalism for at least 40 years. So, thanks very much for listening to me. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Some questions? Any questions before?
Could there be any questions after that? Yeah, that is a man. Yes, sir.
I'm a very keen student of political intelligence, as you are. I'm not in your class. I've got a little bit of information here which may be of some assistance. You mentioned that there is a phenomenon around the world attacking the white man.
Yeah, sure.
You're probably aware of the one world government conspiracy, I imagine.
Yeah, sure.
Pardon?
I said certainly, yeah.
Yes. Well, that is the main reason why the white man or the established races in countries that are under attack. I've got, are there any members of Freemasonry in the room?
I don't know, would they admit to being Freemasons if they're Freemasons?
And I imagine, okay, well, I'm not going to be unreasonably derogatory. And I imagine what we say in here is among ourselves.
Chatham House rules.
But I just cleared a load of my possessions out of a barn that a friend lent me to store it. And one of it is an expose on Freemasonry. And in this it states that the average member is unaware of the true original aims of Freemasonry, which goes back centuries. And the original aim was to create an organization where they could scheme conspiratorially to achieve their aim of one world government. And it is linked to a sect or two of the Jewish race. Now, I'm not anti-Semitic, and it doesn't apply to all by a long way, but there are one or two sects. You mentioned control of the world. There are 173 countries with a central bank, and 170 are owned by the Rothschild family.
Can you perhaps answer that? Can you comment on that?
Who are part of, or at the pinnacle of this conspiracy. I'll just make one more point, and then that's it. Another thing I discovered is that there was a very senior Freemason in America called Albert Pike. At the end of the 19th century, he was regarded as a highly intelligent man, but he was the leader of Freemasonry. By the way, I'm not against all Freemasonry at all. I've got a lot of friends, and a lot of them aren't aware of what's going on at the top. Anyway, Albert Pike, I discovered, was the head of the Ku Klux Klan in America.
At the same time?
Yeah. Now, the aim of these one world governments is to cause conflict in countries. That is why they incite migration so much. They want to break down the national thread, and they realize that minority emphasis on minorities will ultimately cause strife and bring the country down, which will make it easier for them to conquer it.
Right.
A few points that may be of interest.
Well, listen, you've raised some deep a whole broad and deep subjects there. I will let you talk. With all respect to what you say, and I understand what you're saying, you're talking about conspiracies, and there's obviously conspiracies in this world, there's no doubt about it. But on the other hand, what's been done to the British people and what's been done to the whole white race right across the white world is not a so blatant what's going on and so willful that the electorate for the last 50 years in this country voted for those creeps. time after time, in spite of all our best efforts, you know, talk about blood, sweat and tears. I don't know, who coined that phrase, blood, sweat and tears? We've done some blood, bleeding and some sweating and some crying. Listen, I know there's conspiracies, but the only good sign that I can see, and it's happened this year, is at long last the British people are starting to turn away from their tormentors. Look, I'm not going to predict who's going to win that election in the United States of America, but I've got a shrewd idea who's going to win. How do I know that? Because I saw what they did to Enoch Powell in this country.
Yep.
The establishment is all powerful and all wicked, but the great sign is that the British people in this country voted Brexit. And I won't say any more because I know there's other speakers. And anyway, thanks for listening to me. Thank you very much.
Yes, he's discreet. He's he always tells the truth. He's the only man in British politics that doesn't lie. He's not called Mohammed. He's a white man. Richard Edmonds. Now, there are nationalists, there are patriots, and there are activists, and there are organisers. Without activists, there is no activity. And without organisers, there is no nationalism. So please put your hands together and give a very warm welcome to a very good organiser, Julie Lake.
Well, first of all, I'm not just overwhelmed at the attendance. I think this is actually the biggest crowd Almondsbury, our secret location, has ever seen. But it's the quality of the people here. And to be perfectly honest, there are people here I've had stand-up rows with. But we come together because we want to push nationalism forward. I was in the British National Party for some time. I wasn't always active. And I found a few months ago, with great sadness, that the party was going nowhere. And you either rule, excuse me, with your heart or your head. And my heart kept me there for a long time, because there are wonderful people who've become my friends. But my head told me nationalism is stagnating. We are not recruiting a new generation. And if we don't do that, I know I'll be sitting in a nursing home 20 years from now, you know, worrying, going to my grave as to who is going to protect our families, our children. I know everyone thinks that. And so, because I've spent my adult life in marketing and sales and recruitment, I tried to analyse what happened, where it stopped, why we stagnated. And I found that, without doubt, as Richard said, that the pinnacle of success for nationalism was 2009 for the British National Party, with all those elected councillors and MEPs. And I was looking for the one defining factor that made that a success. And I found it wasn't one factor. It was a combination, rather like if you bake a cake, you've got six ingredients. If you leave one out, you're not going to get a cake, you get a biscuit. And it was a combination of things. And the first factor was big personalities. And if you compare Nigel Farage to Nick Griffin back in 2009, They are very similar. They're highly educated in politics. They took risks. They spoke their mind. They could hold their own in the European court. They could engage people in speeches. And they weren't afraid. And they were big personalities. The other factor was activists all over the country. They had an enormous base of activists. Every town and city had a branch and campaigns going on. And this is why the recruitment has dried up. Because in 2009, when you had the British National Party in every town and city, they were being seen and being heard. And the human nature is people are drawn to something that looks successful. So every time they were on the television or in the local papers or they were out on the streets campaigning against something, people gravitate towards that because it looks successful and they want to be part of success. And the recruitment is perpetual. Nobody has to go on a recruitment drive because it comes naturally. But when you don't have those activists, when they're not in towns and cities on campaigns, being seen and being heard, the recruitment drops and it dies a death. How can you recruit people when they don't know you exist? But then something else occurred to me was when I very first came into nationalism, there were two or three other parties. And we had the split with Eddie Butler with the challenge to Nick Griffin and then later on with Andrew Bronze. But when they split from the BNP and started their own parties, there was room for another couple of parties. And they hit the ground running. They left the party. They took a decent amount of members with them. They had activists. They had a bit of money. And they hit the ground running. What we have today is, 13, 14 different nationalist organisations. And these aren't new people. They're not new nationalists in these organisations. They're the same people, just doing the rounds. And every time, the activist base gets more and more thinly spread out. And they, instead of hitting the ground running with a decent amount of activists and a bit of money, they're setting up a political party in a Wetherspoons between five of them. They've got no money. They've got no activists, they've got no members, but hey, they've got a great website. Now, if civil war broke out a year from now, or a holy war, or race riots, they are going to be the most unprepared organisation in history. You know, when the British public finally do turn round to the far right and say, oh, you were right all along, help, help. You know, what are they going to do? They're totally unprepared. Because when they set up these new organisations and parties, there's one crucial element they overlook. They all try to replicate the success of the BNP in 2009. But what they forget is, to get to 2009 success took them 26 years. Mm-hmm. We don't have 26 years to bugger about with websites, and it's nonsense. And I've noticed when I first came into nationalism, I had this real sense of pride. It was the camaraderie. It didn't matter if someone else was in a different organisation. You were nationalist. You wanted the same thing. You had a camaraderie. You didn't go to the police about another nationalist. You respected them. And what has crept in recent times with all these different organisations, it's a rather sinister competition mindset. Nationalism is not a competition. It's a way of life. It's a belief. You don't go into competition with someone. You don't attack someone who wants the same as you. And then we have the protectionism. Protectionism in the parties, that we must not cross-contaminate each other. And this was, in all honesty, why I resigned from the BNP. I resigned as regional organiser and on the NEC. Because I believe one of the most damaging aspects is egos and protectionism. So when you think about, well, what are leaders actually protecting? The only thing they're trying to stop is disgruntled members going to the Reds with a bit of information. But if an organisation is run with transparency, integrity and decency to their members and officials, they won't want to go to the Reds. They won't be disloyal. They will still be there in 20 years' time. So maybe some of these organisations ought to start treating their members a little bit better and recognising the hundreds and hundreds of unpaid man hours to promote their party. Not all of them. There's some very good parties, but we've seen a few. And so we now have all these organisations competing with each other in this competition stakes. And I think if anyone calls himself a nationalist and competes against other nationalists and attacks them to score points, they are not a nationalist. I don't want them in my movement. They have no place with us. So, when it comes to cooperation, what are the benefits and are there any negatives? I'm not talking about some fantasy party where we all unite under the same umbrella and Winston Dugar goes and has lunch with neo-Nazi white supremacists. I mean, it's never going to happen. But I have seen few examples where cooperation paid off. And cooperation, I mean respect. We get the respect back for other nationalists, and we're proud of all our nationalists. Doesn't matter what parties they're in, we're proud of all of them. And we support them and encourage them. And one example was, I was working up in Burnley for a BNP candidate in the council elections. Now, at the same time, there was the police commissioner elections running, and of course the BNP can't field a candidate. So without going into too much detail, the UKIP candidate stood down in the council elections, and we promoted the UKIP candidate when we were out canvassing in the police commissioner's elections. Now the result of that, we didn't win, but we did come second. We beat Labour. And we lost to the Tories by 36 votes. We walked out of that count with our heads held high. And I can tell you, those Tories were not celebrating. They were fielding calls from Party HQ. How the hell did you let them get that close? And if you imagine if we replicated that all over the country. Another example, I went to Batley. Batley and Spen, lovely little town, isn't it, Richard? And there's a very small high street. It's probably not even to the end of that field, but it's very busy, very vibrant. And I didn't go there to particularly support any nationalist candidate. I went there for my own reason, to disrupt the Labour vote. But one of the candidates had a very touching email. It was very genuine, from parents whose daughter was gang raped in Batley Snooker Hall by Muslims. And apparently, they approached Joe Cox, no reply. And Tracy Brabin, the Labour candidate, stated to talk about Muslims raping children was vile, to even talk about it. So when I got to Batley, which I kept calling Batley because I was born in Brighton and Hove, but when I got to Batley, it was evident that in this little high street there were gangs of activists from each party, and everyone was friendly. We were all hugging, waving, but I just thought, my God, could you imagine if they all got together in this little high street? And the candidate who got the email from the parents, he had some fantastic placards made up, very professional, saying Tracy Brabin and the Labour Party ignore Muslim rape gangs. And we were holding them up at traffic lights. But could you imagine if there was one candidate there like Richard, and every one of those activists stood in that high street side by side? And by the way, in Batley, not one single person I spoke to told me they felt it was disrespectful to contest the by-election. They weren't bothered. There were shameful posters everywhere, love like Joe, vote Labour. And I went with one of the candidates to deliver Tracy Brabin a cake. She likes cake. She eats a lot of cake in the Muslim community, and she goes and has tea with them. So he baked her a cake and he iced on it, because Greg's the bakers weren't really happy, icing Muslim raid gangs on the cake. But he thought he'd just remind her that it was still going on. So we delivered the cake to the Labour Council offices in Bateley High Street, and that candidate was assaulted by Labour thugs. Tracy Brabbins, Labour staff, manhandled. And you can imagine the other side, if that was one of us, you know, far-right thug attacks. But we got the message across, that was the good thing. When I got home, and I was on Twitter, two of Tracy Brabbins' election staff told me my argument. My argument was they were a bunch of hypocrites, because I remember Airey Neave, 1979, Sir Anthony Berry, who died in the Brighton bombing in 1984, and Ian Gow, murdered in Eastbourne in 1990. And I remember them because I was born in Brighton. And I remember Labour couldn't wait to get their candidate's name in the hat quick enough. And in actual fact, I remember in Eastbourne, the Conservatives asked the other parties to stand down as a mark of respect to Ian Gow, and they refused. And it was actually the Lib Dems who took that Eastbourne seat. So I flagged up the hypocrisy, and one of Tracy Brabbins' supporters told me they don't count because they were killed by terrorists, and the IRA aren't operative anymore, so it doesn't count.
Oh.
This is the brain matter of what is heading campaigns for Labour. The other one said, those murders don't count because it was years ago and nobody remembers them. I said, Ian Gow's daughter remembers. So that's what we're dealing with. When we're dealing with people like that, why are we using this protectionism? Because I can tell you now, when somebody has put in years and hundreds of hours of unpaid voluntary work, what protectionism creates is secrecy in the leadership. That secrecy creates suspicion. And then with suspicion, resentment sets in. And they leave anyway. You lose your members anyway because they're fed up with being scrutinised and having conduct committees, even phoning you up to see what you're posting on Facebook. It's ludicrous. But if we took away that suspicion and we had the freedom to mix with people who we wanted and pursue our own campaigns, if we want to go and support a protest on the Badger Coals down in Somerset, then we should be free to do it. Not, well, it's not in the doctrine of the party, so it might bring the party into disrepute. We need to get rid of that protectionism and that competition element that has crept in. I don't think there's a place for it anywhere. What I want to do in the South West, and it's evident here with the amount of people here, when you look at the years of experience in this room, it's staggering. It's decades of electioneering, campaigning. Some of these new organisations setting up, they've never even organised an election campaign. They have no experience. They have no money, they have no activists, no member base. But they think they're going to be the next Nigel Farage or Nick Griffin. If you work it out, if there's 13 nationalist organisations, to be on the level the BNP were in 2009, we all have to recruit, 12,000 members to equal the BNP in 2009. That's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of new recruits. Where are they coming from? They're not going to come from UKIP. I'm convinced some of these smaller organisations sit there with their fingers crossed thinking any day now UKIP's going to implode and they'll all come, there'll be a tsunami towards the far right and towards their organisations. I don't think it'll happen. I think they'll either split and form a breakaway party or they're scuttled off back to the Tories. We might pick up a few stragglers, but we are not going to get UKIP members queuing up to join us. So where are we going to get these hundreds and hundreds of thousands? If we don't recruit new people, nationalism will fizzle out in 20 years. But when we do recruit young people, there's young people sitting here today. There were some young people in Batley who had a great deal of energy. I believe they should have, we're not in competition. It's not like two businesses competing against each other. So we should support them. And that support could even be something as small as an email, just to offer good wishes and support. That means a lot to someone who's coming into nationalism for the first time, to have the confidence of the peers of the realm, such as Richard and Jez, who've been in nationalism decades. And it's not about all joining together in some fantasy united party, but it's about dropping the egos, dropping the suspicion, dropping the competition. Because it's eating away at what we're actually trying to do, which is preserve this country for the future of our children. Why do we let these outside negatives destroy us? I've seen new organisation slating the National Front because they're in T-shirts, they've got tattoos. I look upon what I call the boots on the ground. They're the most vital element in nationalism because they're our shop front. They are what the public sees and they are what the public forms their perception of. Now, we have a situation at the moment, whereas, for example, an invented scenario, let's say in Liverpool, another mosque is proposed. One of the organisations will say, right, let's get down there and protest. And because the activist base is so spread out and dispersed with all these organisations, they get down there, then the other organisations in Liverpool say, well, yeah, well, we agree with them, but we can't go down there because the BNP are already down there, or the EDL are already down there, or Britain First. And then they are the shop front. They're there protesting. So when the cars drive by and the people scuttle by on the way to the shops, they look over and they think, oh, what's going on? Oh, they're objecting about the mosque. Oh, look, there's six of them. Well, that's going to be no good, is it? That's what happens. But if a call went out to the whole of Liverpool and said, look, forget your egos, forget your status, you know, and the call went out to every single nationalist party and every single independent nationalist, there could be 200 people on that site. There could be 400. So the next time the public are driving past or on their way to the shop, they'll look over and think, wow, something's kicking off. Something's happening. That looks exciting. I'm going to go over there and find out more. And that's the shop window. If you had a fruit and veg store, you wouldn't put a couple of manky carrots in the window, would you, and expect, you know, passers-by to come into your shop and look further. You dress your windows with expertise and precision to attract the passers-by. And that's what we have to do. We have to cooperate. We have to dress our shop window better. We have to support our young people in any way we can. Forget the egos, forget the competition, and anyone who attacks any of our long-standing members, we do not have in our movement. That's it. Thank you.
So bringing folks together, Julie Lake, thank you very much.
The anti-white system, in tune to the pro-white system.